a step away from paradise. What that would mean to you could be many steps away from what it would mean to the person standing right next to you. In 1962, a Tibetan Lama, Tolshak Lingpa, followed his path to the Shangri-La high in the Himalayas, a path that demanded dedication and devotion. Thomas Shore, author and photographer, investigated this true story and wrote it down in a book. Stay tuned. This is Robin with Tributaries. Thomas, you've written many books, and the extents you went to research A Step Away from Paradise seemed more like a calling. Could you tell us about the time and miles it took, and where did you find the final piece, which became the book?
At the time, I was actually living in Darjeeling, which is in the eastern Himalayas, sort of above Calcutta, above Bangladesh on the eastern side. And I had been living there for quite some time. And I was really there with the idea of finding a story. And so I sort of had my ears open. It all sort of started when a friend of mine in Gangtok, which is in Sikkim, the capital of Sikkim, just north of Darjeeling. It's now a part of India. It used to be a separate Himalayan kingdom. I have a friend there who is a tanka painter. And tanka, as many people will know, is the kind of traditional Tibetan religious painting form where they make the various Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and deities. And one day he said, well, you know, you're a writer, you like writing. Well, my mother-in-law has a story that will change your ideas about reality. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, just wait. She was 75 and she had become a nun a few years earlier and was off on retreat somewhere, but would be coming back. And he said, when she's back, you come bring a recorder and she's going to tell you a story and I'll interpret from the Tibetan for you. By and by, this did happen. And she told me this amazing story about how she was from Bhutan, which is just a little bit further east from there, a separate Himalayan kingdom. And they had grown up always hearing that there was this hidden land in Sikkim on Mount Kanchenjunga, which is the third highest mountain on the planet. And there was a prophecy that a lama would one day come and appear at this Tashi Deng Monastery. It's sort of like the auspicious center of the kingdom of Sikkim, and that he would be the one to open up the way to a hidden valley of immortality. So she heard this and she immediately wanted to go and told her husband, let's go. And he said, well, you must be crazy. We can't just leave. And she said, I don't care if you go or not, I'm going. And he said, okay, I'll go too. And then they went with a monk friend of theirs and they traveled to Sikkim and they went to Tashi Deng Monastery. And the Lama and his followers had already left for the high mountains. So she went up there and she told me this amazing 2 or 3 hour story of how they got a donkey and how they had sacks of grain that they would put in caves and relay it up the mountain, trying to find the Lama to go to this hidden land of immortality. And so she told me this whole amazing story. I immediately saw this is sort of right up my line of crazy, meaningful stories that I could write. And so I went back and asked her the next day, you know, do you know anybody else that went on this expedition? Half wondering if she was just sort of this crazy woman with this crazy story. And she told me about some other people who then told me about other people. And then I started following up leads. The leads ended up taking me all throughout that part of the Himalayas in the east, and then eventually to Himachal Pradesh in the western Himalayas, where the Lama had lived before that. And maybe 5 years I was working on the research for this, meeting an amazing group of people who in 1962 had given up their houses and all their possessions, expecting never to be coming back.
Tell us about the event in Tolshuk's youth when he plucked a purba from the air that actually cemented his destiny to become a high Lama.
Yes. What happened was he was actually from eastern Tibet, a place called Golok, from a monastery called the Domang Gumpa, the Domang Monastery. And there's a special class of Tibetan Buddhist lamas who are called treasure revealers. And where this all came from, the man who's purported to be the founder of Tibetan Buddhism was Padmasambhava, who in the 8th century brought Buddhism from India. He was actually, I think, from the Swat Valley, which is now Afghanistan, but was then Buddhist. And he's the one who brought Buddhism to Tibet. And he went up there and kind of subdued the local deities and turned them to the Tibetan Dharma, to the Tibetan religion. And he had this great foresight where he knew that there were teachings that he couldn't give now that the world wasn't ready for. So he would hide the teachings in sometimes in rocks, in the air, in lakes, in all different elements, with the idea that then he would also, in one of his disciples, plant the knowledge for how to find this hidden treasure at a later time when it was needed. And so ter is the word for treasure, and terma is the word for treasure. And a chertan is a treasure revealer, one of these special lamas. There's then the lingpas, who are sort of a special crazy class of these lamas. And so his father was also a chertan. And so this boy showed himself at a very young age to have special abilities and could learn the texts very easy. He was being trained as a monk. And one day his teacher, the head of the monastery, brought this boy and the other young novices into a cave. And there he did some special ritual and I think put the kids all into some kind of a trance is what my guess is. And then he had a bowl of rice in front of him and he threw some of the grains of rice up into the air. And the story that I heard, and I should say that I got this story from this lama's son, who was actually one of my main informants, he told me that what happened was that the lama threw the rice up into the air and it turned into shimmering porbas. And a porba is like one of the ritual objects that the Tibetans use. They usually have a porba and a bell in each hand when they're doing their rituals. So they're quite important elements in their ritual life. And there were these porbas shimmering in the air in front of them like a vision. And all the other kids scooted back. And this one boy went out and picked one out of the air and brought it out of this visionary realm and held it and kept it and had it for the rest of his life. So that's the story of what happened there.
Yes, and as a true visionary, he could hold such a vast perspective. And in doing so, he didn't hold to the usual mores that humanity holds. And first of all, I love the word chertan because I think it describes so much, and it describes so much of that type of crazy wisdom that he had. And learning all about this, I would imagine that your perception of what is possible or what could be true had to have been adjusted.
Yeah, it was something which came up entirely throughout the whole research and the writing and since of this book. I mean, a lot of reflection on my part about this. For instance, with the porba, I have to ask myself, did this really happen? And I know that he really had a very special porba. I've seen pictures of it, and I know what happened to it at the end. It was put into a stupa. I, of course, have to ask myself whether this story is actually true or not. Did he really do this or not? And I don't have any set opinion on that. And I think in the book, I'm also very careful. I don't really put an opinion on, did this miracle happen? I would say that this is the story, and it had a true impact on the people who knew him. I think as the writer of the book, it's not my place to say, you know, whether I believe even that this hidden land exists or doesn't exist. I think what really attracted me to the story and other things that I've written is I like very much that it's a true story of a journey to a fantastic land. Everybody that I interviewed, and there were many, many people that I really spent time with and stayed in their houses and really spent effort traveling to and meeting this amazing subset of humanity who had given up everything to go with this lama, expecting never to return. And I would ask them, what was this land going to be? What was the gate to be getting there? And I would get all different answers. Some people thought that it would be like a real, like a V-shaped mountain ravine with a gate, and they would go through it and it would be suddenly a green land. Or his son thought it would be like a waterfall, and you would jump through the waterfall, sort of like going through Alice's looking glass, and you would enter this land from which you would never return and you would never die.
As you just mentioned, it held many things for many people. And jumping out of the book into humanity and where we are in history, for me, it kind of spoke to allowing for so much possibility and not making anybody wrong about what they believe. I was going to talk about this at the very end of our interview, but to quote Tolshuk, don't listen to anybody. Practice your own version of madness. And I think those are good words to follow in this sense where we can move along and be who we are and who we're meant to be without stepping on anyone else's toes, so to speak.
I think that's exactly it. And the tone that I keep and wanted to make into the book, that I sort of would think that the reading experience would be a good one if at the end someone closes the book and just has a sense of wonder and of possibility. And really, who the hell knows? You know, is there a land of immortality? You could say, come on now. For myself, I think it was really this continual sense of wonder that this crazy expedition and this crazy llama at the head of it even occurred. Right. And the further I went into the story, the more strange paradoxes I would just listen to. And I think this is just like fairy tale. And then I would talk to other people and sort of triangulate, especially towards the end when things really started to happen, and saw that, you know, people really had some very strange experiences. People have asked me, you know, do you think that this land exists? And I've thought about it a lot, of course. And the closest I've ever really come to it would be to say that if you believe without a shadow of a doubt, then perhaps it would really exist. But I would say that I am not of that class of people. And I know that also a lot of his closest disciples told me at the end that they also realized that it was hard for them to truly have that full belief in it.
Who was, of all of the people you spoke to that either traveled with or knew Tolshuk, who gave you the best sense of him? And what was their life like, either now or how they explained it to you at the time?
A few people come to mind. Of course, one is Kunsang, who is Tolshuk Lingpa's son, who was at the time of this expedition, which of course was in 1962 and early 1963, he was, I think, about 17 years old. So he was an adolescent. I spent an entire monsoon in Darjeeling, 3 months every day going to his house. He lived in Darjeeling, where I was also living. And I'd go there every day and record the story, because he knew his father's childhood from the stories that his father told him like no one else did. He's one that I would say that I sort of got the most from. He sort of put it into context. And I was very careful because, of course, a son could glorify the deeds of his father. And as the biographer of this whole thing, you don't want one person's opinion of it so much. So I did check his stories with other people. And there was sometimes an uncanny concurrence of facts that made my own sense of wonder on this whole thing just really grow. Another person that I would say was this woman by the name of Hishe, and she was one of his chondros, which is a consort. Tushuk Lingpa was married and had quite a few children, and he also then took on a chondro, which is, on the one hand, is like a lover. A tertön needs to have a chondro, a woman intuitional guide, which is necessary for the tertön to complement the more male mind, I would say.
Yes.
And I think she was really in love with him. It really changed her entire life. When I spoke with her, she was weeping, and it was very, very moving, because for her, you felt like it was really in her heart. Apart from everything else, it was the love of her life. So it was very, very moving being in her presence.
Right. So did you experience what we might call magic in your journey through all of this, or perhaps beyond that? I know Guru Dev is someone you've written about and experienced on a personal level. What's your experience been like with the mystical side of things?
These things, of course, are sort of hard to talk about. I could say my general path in life, I think from a young age, I had certain experiences which were not in themselves connected to any religion. Yet I had experiences in which I would say that I knew that there was something else going on, and that there was a deeper level of unity, you could even say, behind this world of the 10,000 things, like the Buddhists are fond of saying.
Yes.
And so it set me on a course, which I studied comparative religion and literature. And so I was looking for others who had some guideposts to this realm that I knew was there. And so this has set me on a course of meeting people who have some level of understanding, who have reached some certain level. And I think I've been very lucky in my life in a way that I've been able to have close contact with a few people who I would say are in that realm. Very early on, my first time going to India, I got onto a boat and happened to sit next to this elderly American man who was on his way to India. And he was an ex-Harvard professor. He had left everything behind and he had lived in India for years and he was on his way back to India. He didn't believe in money. He was something very extraordinary. And within an hour of meeting him, he said, "I think you should come with me to India." And I was at the time 21 years old. I was scared. He looked sort of like a vagrant. He had a tiny little day pack with like one change of clothes or not even in it. And he had traveled from the States through England and hitchhiked down on his way to Athens. And I ended up going with him and traveling with him in India. That was my introduction to India. And of course, I've spent years now in India. I've had a lot of chance occurrences, like how this book fell into my lap from my friend's mother-in-law telling me about it.
Right. I wouldn't even put that on luck previously when you said you were lucky.
No,
I have this thing with that word lucky. It's like, maybe it wasn't
that's
luck.
With Ed Spencer, this man that I went to India with, he really got it. He had it. I think he really had the understanding, the way he lived his life and everything. But in the end, it was like his way and my way wasn't the same because he was a real renunciant and I'm not a renunciant. In the end, it would be wrong for me to sit under anybody else's tree. You have to plow your own field and dig in your own garden to find the gold. Like you mentioned another book that I wrote called The Master Director. When I was living in Darjeeling, Sikkim area, I ended up walking into a village where they were all excited because their living God was coming, their guru, their master was coming that night. And the man whose house this guru was going to stay and invited me to stay and I could meet him. And I met him and he ended up taking me very close. Whenever I was there, I could just go and travel with him and he would go from event to event where there were hundreds and often thousands of people coming. Not one to follow a guru, finding himself the special close disciple of the biggest guru of Darjeeling and Sikkim at that time. So it was sort of surreal at times. I am trying to come to understand the world in my own way. So it was one of these kind of funny paradoxical situations that I was, you know, ending up
privy
like
to,
the
yes.
right-hand man of Guru Dev. And so...
We're going to move off the writer or include the writer along with your artistry in photography. So as this artist, how do you experience the interplay of writing and photography?
In two ways. One way is that some of my books, especially Step Away from Paradise and Master Director, each of them have, 80, 90 photographs in them. My idea is that it helps the reader visualize what the scenes are, what the places, what the people are. So it's sort of an important element of telling a story in that respect. Very often, you know, I will have talked to someone and then I transcribe the notes and then I write it and then I go over it. It's like three steps removed from the present moment in the end. When I'm in the middle of writing, very often, you know, I'll be writing all day and then by late afternoon, I just grab my camera and there I'm trying to grab a 250th of a second moment. It's sort of the opposite of this ponderous process of writing and it uses the visual sense instead of the language. It's spontaneity. is what I think it is. You do what it is in the moment without an idea. Like, you know, here where we are, just before we started talking, my wife and I went walking up the hill above this house on the side of this Greek mountain where we are because the clouds were just pouring over the mountain. It's just so beautiful and moving to see they're right over your head and you become foggy and it goes up again and they're twirling and tumbling. And I realize how it's completely by nature. It is happening on its own. Mm-hmm. It expresses tremendous beauty, yet there's human beings would then, we know that it's a condensing point of water at a certain temperature and that one atom hits another atom and that makes the wind and all this. We can describe it, but you know, if we were to make the wind, it would have angular, if we were to make clouds, they would have square angles in them.
Yeah.
But then it's just nature itself. You need nothing more. It's our abstraction. That's why I've always avoided any system of thought whatsoever. Like to be a Buddhist, I see the Western Buddhists and I sometimes think they're really doctrinaire. And I've spent too much time living in the Tibetan Buddhist diaspora world in India to see their underbelly. And I know that they're also ambitious and they're also greedy people. And even the big lamas, I know, I know true things that have happened because I've seen it. And I know that the big monasteries have young monks who are malnourished, literally, in these glorious palaces. Their malnourishment, they're abusing children in there. And that pisses me off. You know, that's not right. But yet they'll build another big, you know, stupa or a big monument to a Buddha. And that's not right. And so I don't adhere to any of it. And it's like from within myself, I have to forge my own way. I've spent time, you know, with Ed Spencer, this guy I went to India with, or with Gurudev, with whom I have great respect. I'll sit under someone's tree, learn something, and then before I get all goggled eyes about it, I'm going to stand up and say, thank you very much. Like, I really love
Have
you
a nice
for
day.
That.
Yeah.
But if I don't find my own way, then I'm going to be lost. I can't be a follower. I was raised atheist and with the Western scientific mind, and my name is Thomas, and Thomas is a doubter. And I will first doubt it. It's like when I go into some place where there's some guru, I always feel like I'm the guy carrying this heavy anvil in. And I take his words and what he does and says, and I put it on the anvil and I start pounding it to see whether it's real gold. And that's what the Buddha taught. He says, don't take my words, try it, test it. If it's right, then it's okay. If not, move on. But test it. Don't believe me just because I have authority. So I'm anti-authoritarian and try to be spontaneous.
Ditto.
I'm not very good at it.
No wonder we've met. So Thomas, I just want to ask you, you know, you've written various books and you don't even want to try and put your fists down hard and say, this is the truth and this is how it happened. And how does that all affect where are you going next with your writing?
I guess, I mean, right now I'm in the middle of writing another book, which of course is a long story to explain, but to put it very, very succinctly, where we live in India, a man moved in downstairs monsoon before last, like summer before last, for about 2 months. And it was also one of these things that was not chance, but it was like he had a story and I was the scribe of stories. And so very quickly, by the time of meeting him, it was like by mutual agreement without even, I don't really remember how we even agreed to it. It was just a given fact that I would write something based on his story. So I spent a couple of months every day going down to his rooms, collecting his story. And he's another one of these crazy stories in that he was born with a birthmark on his arm that was the same as the birthmark of the saint that his mother went to ask for the blessing of a son, because she had had 3 daughters in an Indian society. You need a son for various reasons, especially at this time. He's quite an old man now, so he was born long ago. And this saint had died right then, 9 months about before he was born. So he was born with the same birthmark as the saint. So he was born with the expectation that he was going to be a saint, a godman, a baba, a guru, a whatever. And he had to live with this his whole life, first questioning, do I have a special connection to the gods? Am I a godman? And everyone, you know, his entire environment telling him that he was. So it affected him, of course, throughout his life and actually pushed him into asking the deeper questions that most people might ask here and there, like, what are we doing here? Who am I? And what is this God that people talk about? It pushed him through his whole life till he actually had a full-blown experience. He sort of went through a real dark night of the soul. He disintegrated as a human being with these questions and almost died physically and mentally, was sort of unaware of what was around him, and he had a great illumination, his story.
Nice. So one more question then. As a writer of that element of being a seeker, what one word would you describe as a quality that you need and that you have? As their storyteller, as a storyteller of these tales, and, you know, the hours you listen to people and the travel that it takes you, what's one thing? I mean, would it be patience or curiosity, do you think? Or
I think just an open mind, actually.
Beautiful.
you know, every single one of these people have their faults. It's like, I think we think that someone who would be a, whatever you want to call them, a saint or an enlightened being or something, we who are looking for that or looking for that in someone, we have assumptions of what they're going to be like, right. That they will be perfect, that they will not have human flaws, that they will not have selfishness. And maybe anybody can have this experience and can reach that level. You know, it can be, it won't necessarily change who they are.
Right.
And I think that that's it. So it's to sort of give up our own ideas of what we expect them to be and get angry when we find that they are someone like this man I'm writing about. You know, he says, I easily could have become a Baba. I could have been a preacher, a teacher, a saint, but then I wouldn't have my freedom. Then if I want to have a drink, I don't want to be one of those Babas that hide the bottle. If I want to have a drink, I'm going to drink it outright, and that will confuse my followers. So please know, you know, he renounced it. And he always said his whole life, he said, I'm trying to kill the Baba, because, you know, that the saint that was going to, and in the end, the saint killed me, meaning that it also exploded his ego in the end, right. By fighting it. And he says that it's by fighting. It's not by staying some middle path. He often talked about the Buddhist middle path and all these right. People who are following the middle path. They don't know their own dark. He says, you know, you have to explore your darkness. We have to muddy ourselves in this world. You can't just be clean. You right. Have to first get dirty. You have to fight with your devils and with your demons. Mm. I think that that's really true, because we are yes. Human beings. Yes. And so we have to do that. So right. That's my, not my one word answer, but there it is.
I'm glad you went beyond the one word. No, I like that as a finish. Thomas Shore's book is A Step Away from Paradise. Anything Tributaries related can be found at tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are hopefully where you would like to find them. Many thanks to KGNU Radio. This is Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.